for the League of Champs, an arena where we invite everyday athletes, coaches, and entrepreneurs to discuss the methodologies they use to affect change and achieve purpose. League of Champs sits at the intersection of mindfulness and sport with one intention: victory. Join us. What's up, what's up? Happy Monday. If you're listening to this on a Monday, welcome to League of Champs. We have Matt Taylor from Tracksmith on the day. Matt, welcome to the league. How you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Right on. Thank you for joining us. Crazy times right now with everything going on in the world. I don't formally prepare bios or background, so maybe you can just give us a quick rundown of, who you are, what you do, and where you're from.
Yeah, no worries. I'm the founder and CEO of Tracksmith, performance running apparel brand based in Boston. I grew up in Pittsburgh, so sort of born and raised there, and migrated up to the New England area for college, and have pretty much stayed up here ever since. And so, you know, New England feels like home to me, although Pittsburgh is still my first love in terms of a city. So, right. But yeah, that's a really cool. Short background.
Steelers fan, presumably.
Yeah. You can't really grow up in Pittsburgh and not be a sports fan, and it's hard to also grow up there and not be fans of the Pittsburgh teams. I'd say the one exception for me personally, I was a huge New York Mets fan in the 80s. Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden, you know, that was my team. Yep. I would go to the Pirates games when they played the Mets wearing a Daryl Strawberry jersey, and as a 10-year-old, took a beating in the stadium doing that. And then basketball, we didn't have a team. So, I was, obviously as most, I played basketball through high school. So I was a huge basketball fan and grew up at the height of the Jordan era. And so would occasionally convince either my parents or parents of one of our friends would, maybe once a year, if we were lucky, we'd make a trek to Cleveland when the Cavs were playing the Bulls. Nice. and try to take in a Jordan game from the nosebleeds. But, But Steelers and I do love the Pirates, and then I didn't grow up a huge hockey fan, but again, when you've got Mario Lemieux and you're winning Stanley Cups, it's hard not to get
tough
into
to get away. Yeah.
Into those sports. Exactly.
Yeah, for sure. Same for me. It's like I grew up in Michigan, so Pistons fan by nature, but as soon as I found out who the Bulls were and Michael Jordan, it like totally shifted my my fandom. And Red Wings, obviously growing up too, just with how they were winning and so on and so forth. So are you a Red Sox fan now, or are you pull for Pirates? Like, how does that work now? Or Mets still?
I know. No, not the Mets. When that team was over, my love for the Mets kind of faded as well. Yeah. I do like the Red Sox. I also played baseball growing up. So baseball, basketball, and running were sort of my sports.
Nice.
And, Red Sox and Pirates are in different leagues. So it was, always, and the Pirates haven't had a winning record in like ridiculous 30 years or something, So I like the Red Sox. The Patriots is the one I'm married to a New Englander, New Englander and a Patriots fan. So for the sake of the family, I politely clap when the Patriots win, but deep down, I just can't quite get on.
Yeah,
I can't quite get on.
Especially as a Steelers fan, man, that's tough. That's really, really tough. Right on. Well, thanks for the intro. I mean, that's a perfect sort of setup for your intro into sport and sort of love of sport. Like, did you played basketball, running and baseball in high school? Did you run in college too, or like what was that transition like?
Yeah, so I played baseball, basketball, and ran my freshman year of high school, and then running and basketball, I guess was better at those two. And so then by my sophomore year, I was just playing basketball and then running cross country and outdoor track.
Right on.
And did that all through high school, and was a better runner than I was a basketball player, so I couldn't play basketball in college. So by the time I went to college, I was running. In college it's year round because you have cross country in the fall, indoor track in the winter, and outdoor track in the spring. So three all three seasons you're competing and training. So, and so, yeah, I ran, you know, all 4 years in college and, you know, just carried on after school, and still run and, you know, train and race today.
Nice. When did you really fall in love? Was it with running? That is, was it like in high school? Like, what was that transition? I know that transition sometimes from high school to college it becomes more of the work ethic once you get to college, cause you're running year round and it's sort of what you do. Did you fall in love like in high school or what? Yeah. What was that relationship like?
It definitely started in high school. What I really loved about my sporting career in high school was the difference between basketball and running. You know, one being a team sport and very high intensity, and you know, we were a pretty good team back then, and so we would, you know, our high school gym would be packed, and that environment is amazing to be able to, you know, play in that type of environment. And, you know, cross country, you're kind of out there on your own, not a lot of spectators, you know, track, same thing. So they were just so different, but I thrived in both. And, you know, my basketball coach was basically like Bobby Knight of high school basketball. I mean, in your face, high intensity. And I love that. I thrived in that. And then my track coach and cross country coach was like the Phil Jackson, you know, like super, philosophical and laid back, and, you know, and I also thrived in that. So I just loved having these changes to my year where I could, you know, personally really dig in and push myself, but then have these external factors that were very different and made me think about things, you know, from different perspectives. So I love that.
Yeah. The dynamics of all that is great. I'm sure that really shaped your perspective as not only an athlete, but a person as well. So was it, I know you ended up at Yale, Lux at Veritas, which I actually, funny enough, have tattooed on my arms,
of the, nice.
your good old alma mater.
Yeah.
Did you know sort of going through high school that you were gonna end up Ivy, or what was that sort of process like?
Yeah, no. To be honest, I didn't even know, like the concept of Ivy League schools isn't something that even registered to me as a high schooler. I wanted to go, I just always loved the big, I wanted to go to Michigan or UNC or Arizona, you know, baseball, basketball, you know, programs. Totally. Not thinking that I would be able to, I mean, when I was younger, I dreamed that I'd be able to play those sports at those schools. But obviously by my, you know, sophomore, junior year, that became, you know, reality hit. But even running wise, you know, I still thought those are the types of schools I wanted to go to. I was fast enough that I got some, you know, scholarship offers and interest from smaller schools, not sort of the big D1 schools, but some of the smaller schools.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I think the first even like acknowledgement of what like an Ivy League program and education was like, I think it was Penn, because I grew up in Pennsylvania. And so they, you know, UPenn recruits, you know, heavily in state. And I think I got a letter in the mail. This was obviously pre-internet, pre-email. We got letters from the coaches, you know, or phone calls on the landline, you know,
old school.
And, exactly. And my, you know, my parents were like, you know, wow, this is an amazing school. And then it's Harvard and then Yale. And it actually ended up that a coach from Colgate was recruiting me. And then he got a job at Yale. And so he sort of midsummer said, hey, I took a new role. I'd still love for you to, you know, be an athlete of mine. And, I'm going to Yale. And so, you know, it was not something that I had thought about. I was always a very good student, you know, always had really good grades. And so, once those recruiting letters came in from the Ivy League schools, you know, that was sort of my parents, thankfully, in hindsight. I still pushed them. I really wanted to go, or even there was a small school in Pittsburgh called Duquesne, that they, you know, had a full scholarship offer there. And, you know, a lot of my friends were staying in Pittsburgh area, and, you know, and my parents thankfully were like, nope, this is something, this is an opportunity you have to take.
For sure. Once in a
while. So, exactly. So, yeah. So, you know, thankfully I got accepted to Yale and went off to school.
Nice. And then once you got there, what was that process like of, you know, everybody sort of goes through that once they get to college. It's like figuring out the path. What was that like, especially combined with being a collegiate athlete? Like, how were you trying to figure out sort of your future once you got to school?
Yeah. I grew up in a household where school was important, but there wasn't sort of that, just like legacy of like, you go to school and you do this, you you take these classes, yeah. You do these internships and you get a job. So I was kind of, rudderless, I think, when I got to school. Growing up, it was like, my grandmother was always like, you should be a doctor, because yeah. Back then, like the game of life, if you yeah. were a doctor or a lawyer, you had a good life, right?
Totally. So security.
I thought I was going to be pre-med, and I realized I didn't like that. And it took me a while to adjust to that environment. And Yale is a very, it's an amazing place because you are surrounded by so many different types of people from so many different backgrounds.
Yeah.
But for sure, there is a handful of that, population as there is at any Ivy League school where their sort of like their direction going into college was much more clear than mine, because maybe their parents also did that. And they had a little bit more guidance, or they came from a private school where, it's maybe a little bit more, set you up more to yeah. handle college and think about your career. So I always say that having a team was the thing that definitely made that transition much smoother. I think if I would have went to school without that, it would have been, I think I would have struggled in that environment. But, immediately week one, you're with a cross country team, and the bonds that happen over sports are, they're amazing, right?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
So that helps quite a bit.
For sure. Do you feel like you had any like core passions too? Like, I mean, looking back, I think, when you first get to school, you may not realize sort of what your core interests are, but like looking back, do you see any sort of thread that was like, oh yeah, like I was naturally interested in this sort of like entrepreneurialism or business or, was there anything there that sort of you think helped your trajectory a little bit at all?
The only thing that I really look back on was I just loved, it's going to sound weird, like observation. Like I realized, maybe not right away, but at some point I realized that I was in a pretty special and unique place. And I sort of liked to just sort of sit back and observe, and try to take in as much as I could. And, that also in a way, was where I went academically. So I did a lot of research. I was a behavioral neuroscience major. It was a joint program between biology and psychology. So I was doing a lot of experiments, in a lab and with human beings. And so that certainly, is something that even today, I think I generally like to gather as much information and not I'm not sort of super reactionary. I like to sit back and observe and listen and form an opinion based on multiple inputs. It's hard to say that's a passion, maybe more a character trait that developed from being in an environment that was slightly uncomfortable for me. And I wasn't comfortable being, I don't know.
It makes a lot of sense though. There's like a natural interest there. And when you think about entrepreneurialism, or just being a marketer in general or a business person, like, there is such a deep, psychological connection to observing the market, understanding sort of the consumer mindset, and not to like draw those direct correlations. But I just think there's, there's power in being able to sort of understand the mindset or the science of the psychology and observe and then, tactfully sort of make decisions based off of those insights. Like you're saying, that's pretty rad. So
yeah,
then through, you know, moving through school, you graduate, and what was that transition like? Because did you end up with a neuroscience degree, or what was your sort of final?
So I didn't do anything related to that at all. although, you know, great experience, and I probably carry a lot of what I learned with me. But yeah, my first job out of school was at IMG, the big sports management marketing firm. I just, you know, still coming back to sports, you know, I guess maybe if there was that one passion, it was sports. And so, you know, my first job, it was amazing being 22 and, you know, working, we were working on, you know, literally building, you know, like Manchester United's website and the New England Patriots website, and trying to work with these Fortune 500 companies who were trying to figure out the internet and how to advertise, and especially across sports and stuff. So it was very fun and, you know, fascinating, time. I had no idea what I was doing, but it was a fun time, to learn and
for sure. And that's kind of like the part of youth, right? It's like some of the best advice I've ever gotten is learn by doing, right? It's just like, you sort of have to just launch yourself into the world and be eternally curious, if you would, and sort of just kind of, you know, fail quick, learn fast, and, you know, take those insights, get that feedback. And that typically helps to, you know, direct, it can at least help to direct, your life in a certain way. It sounds like that was completely invaluable experience. So then from there, I imagine a breadth of learning working for IMG and the athletes and the teams that you were working with. Where'd you lead from there, or where'd you go from there rather?
It was a very, wandering path to get to where I ultimately landed. So I had a startup shortly after that didn't really, go anywhere. I had a short stint in finance because I kind of panicked thinking, you know, all my friends were, you know, doing these other things, consulting and banking, and I panicked thinking that's, you know, maybe that's what I should be doing.
Maybe trying to find some of that stability a bit and just kind of like,
Exactly. So anyway, I eventually got around to doing these sort of, these mini documentary style projects, in the sport. And so, started with cross country, a project called Chasing Tradition, where I followed 11 of the top, NCAA Division I, although there were Division II and Division III school, but basically following the top, collegiate cross country programs during the season, 1 week at each school, sort of documenting their lifestyle, their training, their racing, and anyway, these projects kind of snowballed. I did that, led to, you know, another one and then another one. And, so I really, you know, it was very amateur and very entrepreneurial. The beginning ones I did all by myself. And then later on, as, I was able to, you know, get paid to do them, was able to bring on some people to help. So some of them, you know, were a little better produced than others, but, and then that ultimately led to a role at Puma. And that was really, I think, where I, you know, grounded, myself in the sense that I knew I wanted to start my own business and my own company. But I also was smart enough to know that I lacked a lot of the experience to do that successfully. I had sort of tried early on in my career where I didn't know much and failed. And then I was doing these small projects, which I knew a lot about, but they weren't businesses, they were just projects. And so Puma was a chance to really, basically it was like the MBA for me, right? It was a chance to really learn in an environment that, I had a great deal of passion for and curiosity for. And that then, you know, post Puma, that's when I really started working on Tracksmith.
And that's really rad. So you were doing the storytelling and doing all that production while you were, had your finance job?
No. Okay. After.
Right on. That's super sweet. And so sort of that's a learning curve too. Like you were shooting, producing, and storytelling all by yourself at first. What was, coming from like a storyteller and someone who's worked at large brands before and sort of now kind of doing it myself too. What was that like? Like what programs were you using? What were you shooting on?
I'm assuming YouTube existed, but it wasn't at all what it is today. This was 2000 and probably 2 or 3.
Oh, wow.
A long time ago. So basically I had a friend who helped build the website. He built a custom video upload and display.
Wow.
For the videos, he built a really rudimentary photo gallery that you could, click through images. It was a super simple blog. It wasn't WordPress, but it was something like that. As things went on, I remember like blip.tv
oh, yeah.
for a while,
oh,
and then maybe Vimeo,
yep.
and then YouTube, that was kind of the progression.
Yeah,
And then, I had a, little handheld, I can't even remember what video camera I had, just a little handheld. And I had a, Canon Rebel, camera. So yeah, scrappy, amateur, gritty approach to it. And I had a laptop and that was pretty much it.
That's really rad. I mean, it's pretty cool too, because there is a thread there when I think about Tracksmith and Meter and everything that you guys do from a storytelling standpoint, you can definitely see how that's really come through and such an invaluable piece to the brand to be able to, just tell really, really great stories and I mean, shot beautifully and just, there's a taste level there that really, exemplifies through. So that's really, really rad. As you got to Puma, I worked for Adidas years ago and worked for Red Bull for years. I kind of know what that experience is like. How do you feel like that really set you up to then launch Tracksmith? Because I believe you were working a lot with Usain Bolt and, from a national or international perspective, like what were some of those, like if it, very key marketing jargon, key learnings from being at Puma that sort of helped you transition into Tracksmith?
Yeah. I mean, there was just a lot of like basic fundamental business learnings, right? Just understanding how companies work, learning about the unit economics of the product. I was on the brand marketing side, but had some exposure to other areas of the business, product and sales. Really understanding that, the way Puma was structured, you also had a lot of exposure to our international markets. Puma is a little more decentralized, whereas like a Nike is much more centralized. So, part of our job being at, on the global team at Puma is sort of convincing the local markets that, this is the way running should be presented and here are the things that you should be thinking about. But ultimately, they're kind of responsible for their own P&L. If you're business unit manager or general manager of India, for example, you've got to do what's best for India. And so a lot of the job was also kind of selling, which sounds weird, but that's the way it was
structured. Selling.
Internal sales.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
And then, but then that also forced you to also have a very global perspective, to understand those markets. I couldn't just stand up there and say, this is what's best for, Korea without trying to understand that market and travel to those markets and things. So it was a great experience and you can learn a lot. It also was a big company with a lot of bureaucracy and layers as most big companies are. And so also a lot of frustrations, but that's part of those companies.
Yeah. Name of the game at those big international behemoths is some of that bureaucracy, but it sounds like your sort of psychology and insights training from school really helped. I'm sure during your presentations, you were very well armed with insights of those local markets and able to speak to a lot of that stuff. I want to circle back on one thing, because for anyone listening, especially a younger audience, the unit economics piece, I think, is a critical piece in thinking about building a brand. And for any young kid listening or anyone else listening, when you're starting to think about, you know, making apparel, it's like your streetwear is just a t-shirt, but understanding sort of the metrics of what cost and then profit could be. Could you just explain that a little bit, especially with your experience on a global scale, what that unit economics means?
Yeah. I mean, so my experience pre-Puma, I was never, you know, selling physical products. It was always services, right? Or digital products, which are just, you know, different than when you think about a physical product that has raw materials and manufacturing and shipping.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah, thinking about, you know, how much something costs to make, you know, and what's, you know, really one of the key drivers of what makes Tracksmith really different was sort of flipping the way that's thought about on its head. So let's just take a basic example of like $100 sneaker. You know, it's probably costing the brand, you know, $25 to make that. They sell that to Foot Locker for $50. So they double, you know, they make double, and then Foot Locker sells it for $100. So they make double. And that's a very, I mean, basic, but pretty accurate reflection of a traditional wholesale margin. And so when you're thinking about, okay, I'm going to sell this for $50 and I need to make it for $25, you've got to think, you know, not just the, you know, the raw materials, but then the manufacturing and, you know, where is it going to get shipped to? How are you going to ship it?
Yep.
And all of that goes into create your costs, yep. Right? And so when the direct-to-consumer sort of, you know, boom started, or the rise of these brands like a Warby or a Bonobos, you know, they basically said, okay, if we don't sell wholesale, or let's just assume it was a sneaker brand, but those two brands are probably the best examples that people will know.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, okay, if we don't sell to Foot Locker for $50 and we sell it direct, then we don't have to, the retail price doesn't have to be $100. It can be much less than that.
Totally.
And so that was sort of the original approach to direct-to-consumer was, we will bring you the same product for less money because we're going to cut out the wholesale margin that usually you know, is involved.
Excellent.
And when I started really digging in on the concept of Tracksmith and looking at specifically the raw materials, fabrics, trims, all of those things that go into the product, what became really clear to me was there were better fabrics, there were better trims, there were better construction methods that could be used to make the product. And so instead of sort of trying to make a product that already existed on the market and do it at a cheaper price, we sort of said, okay, what if we just invest that, you know, wholesale margin into better raw materials? What if we work with better vendors? And so, you know, our pricing is, we're on the premium end. It's not crazy compared to where a lot of the brands sit now. Maybe 5.5, 6 years ago when we launched, it felt a little more premium, but the other brands have slowly increased their pricing as well. But that was really it. So it was, you know, let's invest in better raw materials and make a better product. So it's just kind of, it's the same model. It's a direct model, but we just sort of, you know, thought about how we could maybe do that differently. Cause I didn't really have an interest in just making, you know, the same product that was on the market with a different logo on it. I really wanted to create something different and distinct.
Throughout Matt's life, he was really able to develop a skill set in which he processes information, becoming more insightful versus reactive. Navigating through his career path, he found his bliss, as Joseph Campbell once said. Fast forward to kicking off Tracksmith, and he was able to create a direct-to-consumer brand that took advantage of the margins by making a better quality product, which in turn drove value within the brand itself. There's a lot to learn from learning by doing and following your intuition and curiosity to find what you want to do, as well as taking a look at the marketplace, acting on those insights, and delivering a product that really represents the story you want to tell. Yeah, and it really speaks through to the brand right now. I mean, from a quality standpoint, because you went D2C and your margins are much better there, that yeah, you guys have really driven the quality aspect of the brand and the fabrication. And I mean, you can really tell when, I mean, I have your singlets and I run in your shorts, and you can really tell with you know, all the fabrication, which is a good pivot into you know, getting into some of that fabrication. Where did that begin? So I also come from a little bit of a fashion background, just out of college. I've worked for Marc Jacobs for years and had a tie brand at one point. So I'm sort of familiar with the process of samples and,
yep,
and getting things made. And fabric is like the most intimate process in making,
yep,
apparel, especially in trying to, you know, fabricate your own, you know, blends and so on and so forth. So where did that process start? Because to me, that's super interesting. I think as far as the market goes, I mean, in my humble opinion, like, you guys have some of the best fabrication on the market, just in terms of how things feel, especially, yeah, from an athletic apparel standpoint. Yeah, where did that start?
There were really two things that I think led to the first product launches, and then as we continued to grow. One was just an introduction to a textile manufacturer in Switzerland that made, you know, extremely technical performance fabrics, and specifically geared towards, a lot of it was geared towards endurance sports, as well as some other sports, like equestrian business for them was big.
Wow.
Cycling was big. But no brands were working with them on the running side, or if they were, it was like a one-off thing here or there.
Yep.
And so, you know, we dug in there, and it was like, oh my gosh, this is, you know, this fabric's amazing. And at first you're just feeling a header, right? And you're reading, okay, it weighs this much and it's got these properties. And then you sew it up in a block, in a t-shirt or a pair of shorts, and you go run in it. And you know, that's when really it comes to life. And so that was one. We just sort of, you know, got this introduction, and then, you know, followed through this world of, you know, really technical textile manufacturers that, yeah, once you understand they exist and who they are, there's some incredible fabrics out there. And then the other was, frankly, I was and still am a huge fan of Outlier, which, yeah, is a Brooklyn-based, yep, apparel brand. And had gotten to know Tyler and Abe, the two founders, a little bit, and they had launched before us, so they were out in the market, and they were talking about merino wool, and I had never really run in merino wool. I had seen some stuff, and I knew what, you know, smart wool and some of these brands were,
yeah,
but then they sort of again introduced me to I think one of their merino suppliers, and, you know, just sort of did the education of an understanding of merino is not, you know, what you think of when you think of wool. It's not scratchy. It's not heavy. It's, you know, the people that are doing it for performance fabrics are doing it, you know, in a really unique way. And so that was just sort of like, yeah. And we're not, you know, those aren't the only two, you know, fabrics or suppliers we work with, but I would say those are two, like, some of our more technical stretch wovens, that come out of Switzerland, and some of our merino blends that come out of mostly New Zealand, Australia. They're just very different. If you haven't run in those fabrics, you sort of have to understand how special and unique they are. So that really drove our, let's make this a priority. Let's really put a lot of focus on material science and material education, and, you know, again, find these fabrics that, yes, they're more expensive, but they're also at a price point where the other brands can't use them because they wouldn't be able to sell the product, yep, at the right price point in a Dick's Sporting Goods or a specialty running store. And so it gave us a little bit of a open lane to explore some things that no one else was doing in running.
Yeah, that's really special on many different facets because of, I mean, going back to the unit economics, right, and D2C, really being able to drive, you know, quality because of your ability to have the margins. And, Yeah, I mean, from an R&D standpoint, what was that process like? Because, again, you know, you get a sample made or you get a piece of fabric back, you construct a garment, and then you go run in it, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
then you get some feedback. I mean, how is that in the first year or so? Or I guess starting from, like, from an R&D standpoint, before you guys actually launched into market, how long were you working on a product before you actually put it out?
A long time. Yeah. I mean, in the beginning, you know, the very beginning was myself and my co-founder, and our first employee was on the product side. And she had come from an apparel background. And she also was able to make patterns and sew rudimentary samples in the office. And
that's
so
awesome.
Literally in the beginning, we were making, you know, making our own patterns, sewing our first prototypes, running in them, making adjustments. I mean, it was extremely, in hindsight, extremely inefficient, but also extremely valuable to yeah. just sort of go through that process and learn, you know, what these different, you know, decisions or tweaks would create in the product. And so,
totally.
You know, then we sort of moved that to some local factories. So in the beginning, we made everything in New England and New York because we just wanted to be there. We wanted to be on top of it. And yep. so we then were iterating there to their chagrin, you know, asking for multiple protos, which factories don't love, you know, they want to make one or two and go to production. And, but you know, we were thankful that we had some willing partners early on. And so, yeah, so, I mean, it was really, two years probably wow. from, like, you know, first designs to actually, having product made and ready to sell. And now we're on, like, a, you know, 11 to 12 month, cycle, you know, nice. Roughly from when we kick off a season and start design and development until that product's in market. So.
Right on. I mean, yeah, I mean, having a pattern maker in house at the beginning is, like, is invaluable, because typically when you're trying to make garments, getting the pattern made and sort of getting things constructed is the, you know, that is the battle. It's like, that's half of it. Just getting a garment back in hand to be able to say, like, I don't like this, or, you know, this is what we're changing spec wise. So, really, really cool. Cause the brand's technically been around 5 years now, five, six years.
Yeah. Five and a half. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. Coming up on six.
Yes.
Yep.
So it really took 2 years to even get to launch point. And I mean, just it's such a good note for, again, anyone listening who's thinking about, you know, making apparel or starting a brand, just the pre-work that almost goes in before launch point to get a product to a place that you actually want it to be. From a mindset standpoint, Matt, like, what has that been like as an entrepreneur, you know, those 2 years and sort of through R&D and then even the last 5 years to where you are now? Because I feel like the brand right now is at a really, really cool place. What's it sort of taken from a mental and mindset standpoint to really stay on course?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard because there are plenty of, failures, you know, in the beginning. And, even just that process to, you know, I, when I left Puma, you know, my expectations of how long it was going to take were, you know, nowhere near what it actually took. So, you know, I mean, there's all the cliches, but, you know, you just have to be patient and consistent. And, you know, my general approach has been, you know, not to get too high and not to get too low. You know, if things are going really well, understand that something's going to go wrong. When things are going wrong, understand. But I mean, yeah, there was no shortage of times when I thought this just isn't going to work. We're going to have to fold. We'll never even launch. And then after launch, you know, you have your moments of we're going to go out of business. This isn't going to work, you know? And, so yeah, you just sort of have to try to stay even keeled, through that. And, you know, for me, the biggest, factor in, you know, our quote unquote success is finding the right people to bring into the process. You know, it's certainly nothing that I could have done by myself, and have just been fortunate to, you know, sometimes through luck and sometimes through, networks and sometimes through, you know, whatever means, finding people who want to go on this journey with you and, you know, the talent and, you know, you talked about the taste level and all of that stuff, you know, that's going back to my experience. I had done that. I had, you know, yep. I'd been a storyteller. I'd written, I had yeah. taken photos, I'd shot and edited film, but I was terrible at all three of those things. And so I knew what I wanted, but I knew I couldn't do it myself yep. at the level I wanted. And so yep. being able to find the people who could, was just, you know, just critical. So.
Yeah. And there's something to say so
that's
there.
That's been helpful.
There's something that's starting to interrupt, but there, yeah, there's something to say there from being a sort of a player into a coach, right? Like you understand
yeah.
The nuances of the game, but then to get sort of the product to the level that you want, you're able to coach other people and bring other people in, which is really, really rad. So to sort of pivoting from just like a brand standpoint, I think it's really cool because we're at an interesting time. I mean, obviously in the world, not to take that lightly at all, but in terms of yeah. brands compared to these behemoths that are, you know, Nike, Adidas, Puma, so on and so forth. And, you know, I've read True Dog and you look at somebody like, you know, Phil Knight's story and sort of how he was battling against, you know, Adidas in the early stages and really how they were pushing hard to just create the brand that we know is Nike now. And there seems like such an opportunity for, you know, these younger brands or sort of these middle ground brands, if you would, to really carve a mark and make an impact, especially when we start to talk about, you know, athletes and sponsored athletes and potentially even, you know, sending athletes to the Olympics. For Tracksmith being, you know, a running brand, do you see that as sort of the future as being able to potentially, you know, send one of quote unquote your athletes to the Olympics or have a professional that's operating on the same level as sort of these bigger, larger behemoths?
Yeah, I mean, our approach has been very considered strategically, just in terms of knowing the resources that we have available yeah. to us, knowing the market really well. I mean, out of the gates, there was no it would make no sense to try to achieve that right from the beginning. So we've slowly been laying the groundwork totally. And, you know, building the grassroots and community and, you know, gaining that sort of authenticity and credibility that is really important in this particular industry. And,
yeah.
you know, now, I mean, we actually have, we sort of did something a little bit unique where we hired two, you know, quote unquote elite, runners as employees. And so they are full-time employees. And one of them has competed at the Olympics and actually has won two silver medals in the 1500, Nick Willis, New Zealander. And, you know, he's now a full-time employee at Tracksmith and, you know, will hopefully make the Olympics again next year in Tokyo now that they've been pushed to 2021. He definitely would have made it this year based on the New Zealand selection criteria. Yep. But now he's got to sort of re-qualify next year, yep. which hopefully he'll do. And then Mary Kane is another athlete who was a, you know, one of the greatest high school athletes of all time. And then went through a pretty nasty situation at Nike and so has taken a little bit of time off and is back to training and has really big ambitions as well. And so, sports marketing is a, like a beast in and of itself.
Yes,
and having worked on that side of the business before previously at Puma and even before that working with some athletes, you know, I just have a very strong opinion on what it takes to do that successfully.
Totally.
And we just aren't in a position yet to be able to do it the way I think, you know, you really need to do it. So is yeah. that to say, I mean, yeah, Nick Willis could make the Olympics next year. So next year we could have someone at the Olympics.
Totally.
But, it's not part of our plan way it would have been for some of those other brands in the early days when they were thinking a lot about sports marketing and the Olympics providing that platform.
For sure.
To be able to have those athletes, you know, show up on the big stage. So it's not a priority for us, but it might happen.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's to your point, and as you well know, and for anyone listening, it's just the amount of resources and time, energy, strategy, and really, yeah, I mean, money that it takes to compete at that level from a sports marketing standpoint. It's just a lot in order to do it right. And it sounds like obviously you're such a methodical thinker and you know, want to do things at a certain level that it does take a considerable amount of resource to really do it. But for anyone also listening, I will put a link to the notes. There is a really good Runner's World article about Mary Kane and Nick Willis as they've partnered with Tracksmith. And really just a different, sort of a more innovative approach to bringing in athletes and what sports marketing could potentially look like for the future. I mean, we've seen a couple young NBA talent, you know, go work for or intern for New Balance or, you know, sort of take these alternative routes towards being professional athletes and sort of how they connect and get sponsored by brands. So really cool that you guys are sort of leading the charge on that as well. To add to that, is the Hare Athletic Club sort of part of that, your vision of like, you know, a Bowerman or, you know, one of these sort of more premium elite track clubs? Is it sort of to help you develop talent in that way?
No, it's a little bit more, it's a little broader. I mean, basically, you know, what running has always had is very strong community, very strong team component, right? And as a, you know, most of running historically has been extremely local. You would go to your local running shop, you know, you would buy all your stuff there. You would join your local club. But as those walls and boundaries have been slowly eroding, and now everyone's, you know, traveling all over the world to these major marathons or following people on Strava, you know, it's become much more global. And so we wanted to create something that didn't compete with those local clubs because those are important, but almost sat above them as a umbrella, you know. And so people that wanted to have a closer connection to Tracksmith and be, you know, because some people do, right? Some people just want a pair of shorts and other people want to feel much more a part of the brand. And, you know, and so we wanted to provide that. And so that's more, I mean, yes, there are some folks in Heresy who are Olympic trials qualifiers and amazing athletes, but there are also people who are not. And so it's less about an elite club like a Bowerman track club or, you know, one of those types of clubs and more, you know, an opportunity for our community to come together globally. And so that's more what it is.
Yeah. Again, super smart. And you're right. I mean, this community of running and as Knox Robinson would say, this running boom that we're experiencing right now, it's really smart to just have that community element. And I've spoken with Gavin Smith previously, and I know he runs with you guys bunch in Boston. And yeah, it's just awesome that you guys are such an outlet. I mean, Boston is sort of epic center, if you would, for American running, just because of the marathon and everything that happens in Boston surrounding running. So, so sweet that that's an outlet, because you know you do look at some of these clubs like a Tin Man or, you know, a Bowerman, and while it's great, especially like the Tin Man guys, they do a great job of storytelling and all that. It's nice to have like an outlet of more a community approach where sort of your everyday athlete, your everyday runner can participate and join and push themselves in the same way and not have to be trying to make the Olympic trials at the same time.
Yeah. And I will say, like, Tin Man to me is like maybe the model for the future of quote unquote elite training groups versus the old school model was very much like isolation, right? If you were in one of those groups, you were, all you did was train and sleep and eat and repeat that. And Tin Man, I think, is bringing, I mean, they do an amazing job, obviously, with, you know, content and storytelling, but they're also very engaged with their community and their fans in a way that the traditional running clubs are not. And so I have a lot of respect for what they're what they're doing and how they're trying to sort of think about that differently. I think it feels fresh compared to what we're used to seeing.
Yeah, definitely. It feels like a new perspective. And you know, those guys are the type of guys that will hit you back on Instagram. And I think they just launched a training program that people can get involved in. And it does very much so seem like the sort of future framework of how those elite track clubs, because they just bring an element of lifestyle into what it means to be a runner and do some great storytelling on top of that. So yeah, with all that being said, with everything that's happened, you know, this year with COVID and sort of the shutdown of retail, how have you guys sort of navigated through that and looking forward, what I imagine you guys might be back open at this point? Yeah,
not quite. I mean, COVID was obviously caught everybody off guard. And I would say that we went through a period of, 2 weeks, all the weeks are blurring together now, but, in the beginning we were in panic mode. Our supply chain was shutting down and it didn't all happen at once. It was like first this factory shut down and then, we adjusted and figured out how to deal with that. And then, our textile mills in Italy all had to close down and it was like, oh my God, what are we going to do? But I'd say that it pretty quickly, there were some positives. One is, that despite the terribleness of COVID, it has provided a boom for, outdoor endurance exercise, right? So people who used to go to a gym or a yoga studio or were playing, pickup basketball leagues or soccer leagues, they couldn't do those things, but they still wanted a physical outlet and a mental outlet through exercise. And so running and cycling I haven't seen any hard data yet, but just anecdotally what we know and what we hear from, activity on Strava and Whoop and platforms like that is that more people are running. And so thankfully, majority of our business is online. We do have the one store in Boston and we have some wholesale partners and we had planned to do pop-ups at all six major marathons this year. We had to, cancel or postpone. I mean, technically Chicago, London, and New York haven't canceled their races yet, but I'm assuming they will. there certainly was a negative impact to the business, but the e-commerce side of the business, did not, we were panicked and it ended up that didn't really, take the hit that we were originally forecasting and planning for and trying to figure out how we were going to get through that. Yeah. So, we adjusted pretty well. We were able to, again, startups, smaller teams, super nimble. We were able to adjust our supply chain, move some things around. As things were closing down, we were kind of like moving things around, working with our partners to just sort of, help each other out. And so we've got some product delays. We definitely have some issues, but I feel like where my mind was in the first 2 weeks, it was as everyone was going through, like, are we even going to get through this, And now on the, a few weeks in the rear view, our team did a great job of navigating through it. And it's not over yet because we may have some relapses and more shutdowns in the fall, winter. I'll feel a lot better when there's a vaccine and a treatment,
Fully
but, fully but for the most part, exactly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that says a lot. Do you feel like it, because you're D2C and, sort of have built this brand equity over the years that we're able to be, I mean, you just said something else key too, just being a startup and being able to be nimble and sort of move things around and adjust quickly. Do you feel like that has sort of added to how you were able to navigate through the last few months or, kind of what are the, again, key learnings from just being able to pivot like that, audible, if you would?
Yeah, I mean, that's just being, I guess, adaptable and having some smart people, creative people around you who can, make those decisions quickly and move. I wouldn't say that specifically, you could flip this around and, you could say, oh, it's because we were e-commerce and D2C, but I guess the flip side of this is what if there's like some massive global hack of the internet and yeah. no one can shop online, yeah. you know, then it's like all the retail stores will thrive and physical retail people have to go places. So a little bit, I guess, is just sort of luck and timing, you know, but I think, you know, being able to adapt and react to situations, certainly. And that's easier to do when you just have fewer people, fewer decision makers, you know,
Totally.
Can put your heads together quickly in an hour and the team goes and executes. And that's easier to do when it's just a smaller team.
Yeah, because how big are you guys right now, just in terms of total employees?
23 full-time employees.
Good number. Yeah, that makes it a lot easier than being a large international brand with all the talking heads and the bureaucracy attached to it. So
exactly.
With everything else going on, I mean, I've paid close attention, obviously, the last month or so. We've been sort of this civil, you know, uprising throughout the country with the death of George Floyd. And I think from a storytelling standpoint, and even speaking closely with Gavin again, you know, you guys have done a good job of elevating Black voices and also, you know, just really utilizing your storytelling to take the people that are part of your community, the, you know, the voices that are part of your community, and let them, you know, speak and be voices, you know, for themselves as it relates not only to the brand, but just their personal experiences in life. How do you feel like, you know, where does sort of Tracksmith fit in that progress moving forward and sort of the future of the movement of Black lives and supporting change within your community right in Boston, but also I think you guys do have global reach. So yeah, where do you feel like you guys are kind of positioned there?
Yeah. I mean, obviously it's been extremely tragic, but I also would say I sense a little bit of hope and optimism as well.
Totally.
And I don't know what's different now than was different with any other of these cases. But yeah. I think for those of us old enough to remember going back to Rodney King all the way through to George Floyd, something feels different this time for sure. And that gives me a lot of hope. And there's probably a lot of reasons, maybe not a lot, but there's certainly reasons for that, I think. You know, being able to see it, right? Like I'm not a fan personally of social media, but the advantage of people running around with phones and Instagram accounts, seeing that brings it home. I think also collectively, we all individually have our breaking points where we say enough is enough, and that applies to literally everything we do in our life.
Yep.
Maybe this is a case where collectively the majority of people have reached their enough is enough breaking point. So that's also helping.
Totally.
And so, you know, for us, we're committed to doing better. We need to do better, but also we took a moment, I think, to just sort of pause as a business and, you know, lend our platform, which isn't massive, but it's a platform, and to lend it to, voices of color in our community. And the reason to do that was not to pat ourselves on the back. The reason to do that is because I think whenever there's some misjustice or tragedy or something that's, you know, you look at it from the outside and you go, man, that's terrible. That if it's really bad, that can have an impact on you. But when you can personalize it, when you can see it through the eyes of someone that you know, all of a sudden it adds exponentially to your potential response. And so for, I don't know, white people who come to our run clubs and read Gavin's piece, all of a sudden it's not George Floyd in Minneapolis. It's Gavin Smith in Boston. Yep. And holy shit, I know that guy. And I can't believe I didn't think about his experience, right? Or Camila, who we have used in, we've worked with her as an athlete for a number of years in our photo shoots. And so people who follow the brand know her. They know her as an athlete in our photo shoots. And so when they hear it from her, there's a connection there that's going to make it even more powerful. And so, you know, that was, you know, that's not saving the world. We have a lot more to do, but given what was going on, we felt that was the best first action that we could take, was to try to personalize it and bring it home to our community in a way that might even affect them and add to what already was pain and sadness and anger.
As brands around the world begin to face the reality of what it truly means to be inclusive and diverse, Tracksmith, instead of crafting some PR statement, let the people of color from their own community share their story. Creating a human connection is so important right now. After all, Black Lives Matter is a humanity movement for equality, equity, and most importantly, justice. To give voice to those human stories is the first step in many towards the fight for equality. As Matt mentioned, there's still plenty of work to do, such as having a more diverse workforce, having representation within these organizations, which will hopefully lead way to reshaping the way Black voices are seen and heard within our communities. Of course, it's not all that simple, but elevating Black voices and allowing those individuals to tell their personal story puts a face with a name and has the ability to share the personal pains of what it's like to be Black in this country.
Yeah. I mean, well said. And I think you're right in so many different, you know, forms. The humanizing it, right, and making it local, giving a sort of a face to this experience, whether that's Gavin or Camila, is really powerful, because I think, to your point, all too often with social media, it's sort of, oh, that's happening over there. You know, you kind of can look out at the world and see the disruption, or see the pain and the anger and the grief, and it doesn't always connect to home. But to be able to bring it home and sort of humanize it and make it a bit more personal is a part of this process right now of healing that we need to go through, and then the massive change that we need to go through. And yeah, we all have to play our part, you know, in that, and just sort of waking up to, you know, what we can do and why we're trying to do that. And so I will say I appreciate that of Tracksmith, you know, having gotten to know Gavin over the last, you know, couple of weeks here, last month here, primarily because, you know, I saw him on Tracksmith. That's how we met.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, again, a powerful tool. And so that's how we connected. And, you know, we've sort of become acquaintances and friends at this point. And yeah, man, I really do appreciate that. And I think, you know, there's still work to be done. It's a marathon of sorts of sort
absolutely
of what we're, you know, the work that needs to be done in the coming years. And, but I do appreciate what Tracksmith has done thus far. With that being said, with the state of everything, sort of what's your vision of the future for the brand, Matt? I mean, I feel like you guys are in a really, I mean, all things considered, with the way the world is and the economy, so on and so forth, the brand seems to be in a good place and in good hands. What is it like looking to the next, you know, 5 years?
Yeah, I mean, if I could, like, you know, go 5 years in the future and wave a magic wand, I would hope that the brand is not really that different than it is today. You know, like I think that we, you know, we'll focus on continuing to expand and broaden the reach of the brand. And as we grow, we're able to do things a little bit better, and have a little bit more resources behind them. Yeah. But in terms of, like, I don't see the brand being different. And what I mean by that, I guess, is like, we wouldn't go into other sports, right? Or we wouldn't, you know, go outside of what we are passionate about.
Totally.
So, you know, I hope the brand looks and feels the same 5 years from now, but it's just bigger.
Yeah.
And we're able to do more. So, you know, and that, I don't know what that, you know, means on the product side. You know, we talk a lot about extensions there on the media side, extensions there, you know, can we create more content?
Yeah.
You know, events is something we talk quite a bit about. You know, so I would hope that, the brand is, broader than it is today, but everything still feels very rooted in Tracksmith.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
For sure. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, I mean, looking forward to see where you go from here. It sounds like it's been a wild ride thus far. And as a fan of the product, everything, you know, I've got one of your sweatshirts. I run in your shorts and your singlets and even some of your running tights. I mean, I had a deep appreciation as a everyday athlete and a runner myself for the brand. I'm doing Brooklyn Virtual Mile on Saturday, as I will not be in Brooklyn, but I will be running in your London 2020, I think, singlet with the matching shorts, the red and blue, which is awesome. Yep. It's just like there's some pageantry there, even as a, you know, for your little local 1 mile virtual race that you can sort of get dressed, which is, you know, it's the fun part. The racing as a runner is the fun part. It's where you kind of test or get to have a little fun with all the work that you've been doing over the last few months. So I really appreciate the time today, Matt. I know times are crazy, so thank you for carving out some time for conversation. And I mean, a lot of valuable insight over the last hour or so to just, you know, how to get a brand to this point and your personal journey through that. So really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We'll talk to you soon. Hopefully get out to Boston for a run once things get back to normal, and maybe even qualify for a Boston Marathon at some point here, so I can get that experience under the belt as well.
There you go.
Well, Matt,
that's the goal.
Yeah, that is the goal. It's a good goal to have. Well, Matt, appreciate it. And we'll talk to you soon. I will put anything that we talked about in the show notes here, obviously Tracksmith's Instagram, the website, and some links to a few of the other things we talked about. So stay tuned. Talk to everyone soon. Bye.